year-end drive. Thank you all for being supporters. Thank you all for building community. Thank you all for who you are. And I'm Cecil, and I will speak with you next time.
This is our KBOO Fights Back campaign. KBOO knows the importance of community media when we need it most. Help us reach our goal of $75,000 by December 31st. Join KBOO Community Radio for an in-person meet and greet at the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Stop by KBOO on Saturday, December 6th or Sunday, December 7th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Meet radio hosts and producers, members of the board of directors, and fellow KBOO community members. Enjoy coffee or tea and light refreshments, take a tour of the station, and make your year-end donation in person. For more information about KBOO Fights Back in-person events, visit kboo.fm/in-person2025. Thank you for supporting KBOO Community Radio.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from the Bureau of Labor and Industries, Child Care for Construction, working to provide resources and support for new journey workers and their families, in partnership with Business Oregon. More info at oregon.gov/BOLI/apprenticeship, under the link Financial Assistance for Registered Apprentices.
I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour, a program of social and political commentary from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist, anti-colonial point of view. I'm John Nelson. Today on the Old Mole, Against the Grain and Sasha Lilly, speaking with Andrew Hartman, professor of history at Illinois State University. He's the author of Education and the Cold War, The Battle for the American School, and A War for the Soul of America, History of the Culture Wars. His book, Karl Marx in America, was published in 2025 by University of Chicago Press. Here's Sasha Lilly for Against the Grain and the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Community Radio.
Today on Against the Grain. While we're told by politicians that the ideas of Karl Marx are foreign and have no place in this country, History proves otherwise. Andrew Hartman shows that Marx and Marxism have had a significant influence on the United States, from Marx's journalistic writings for the New York Daily Tribune to the mass politics of the Socialist and Communist parties and the Wobblies, and on the most radical edge of the New Deal and the New Left, and finally, with the return to Marx's ideas since the global financial crisis. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Marx has been embraced and reviled in the United States, on the one hand by those wanting to understand capitalism and move beyond it, and on the other by those who have branded Marxism wrongheaded or dangerous. Andrew Hartman argues that the fortunes of American Marxism have followed a cycle of boom and bust, the bust taking the form of often severe repression of the left. He posits that we're now in the fourth major boom of American interest in Marxism, which he expands upon in his new book, Karl Marx in America. Hartman is professor of history at Illinois State University. When I spoke with him recently, I started by asking him why was it that Marx was particularly interested in the United States?
Some of it was political and intellectual. The United States, he had already recognized by the 1830s, 1840s, was quickly becoming one of the most rapidly advanced capitalist countries. He was also interested in the fact that the United States had, relative to Europe, universal democracy, or what historians now more accurately call white male suffrage. So he assumed that perhaps the working class, if it got organized, might usher in socialism through the ballot box. He also became increasingly interested in the United States after the 1848 revolutions in Europe had failed, because so many of his comrades whom he had fought those revolutions with in Prussia had immigrated to the United States. He kept up correspondence with them, and so he knew a great deal about the United States. And then during the 1850s, he was the European correspondent for the New York Tribune, published by Horace Greeley. It was a Republican Party newspaper, the most widely read newspaper, in fact, in the world at the time. It had about 200,000 subscribers. All of this kept his focus on the United States. But then in particular, when the Civil War broke out in 1861, he wrote several long articles for European newspapers about the Civil War. He picked up the pace of his correspondence with lots of the 48ers. Those were the German emigres who had, by that time, many of whom were fighting in the Civil War along the Western Front, along the Mississippi. They were deeply anti-slavery. They were rising up the ranks of the Union Army and trying to convince everyone they could that the war needed to be about the abolition of slavery. This is a position that Marx took strongly. In fact, he argued that not only is slavery immoral, and not only would the abolition of slavery help build working class power, because it, as he wrote often, including in the first volume of Capital, is very difficult to build up working class power when half of the working class, as he put it, was branded in black skin. That is, when part of the working class was enslaved, the other part of the working class could not really organize effectively. And then also, he recognized very early on what it took Lincoln a couple of years to figure out during the course of the Civil War, and that is, once the war was about the abolition of slavery, it would be easier for the United States to defeat the Confederacy, precisely because there were so many people who wanted to fight the war to abolish slavery, especially enslaved blacks or formerly enslaved blacks. And so what later W.E.B. Du Bois refers to in his great book, Black Reconstruction, as a general strike, Marx was conceptualizing the enslaved black people of the Confederacy laying down their work tools and fleeing to the Union lines. He was already conceptualizing this as a war strategy.
You mentioned a few minutes ago that the New York Daily Tribune, which Marx wrote for, had the highest readership of any publication at the time. How influential were Marx's journalistic writings for the Daily Tribune? Who do we know who read them and were influenced by them, you know, for better or for worse?
So Marx's Tribune articles were mostly about European politics. He wrote over 500 articles. They were not published with bylines, as was the habit of the Tribune at the time. It's very much like The Economist has always been, published anonymously. But anyone who was everyone as a Republican, or everyone who was anyone, I should say, read the New York Tribune. So this would have included, of course, Abraham Lincoln. So we can expect that Republican Party leadership in the 1850s, right on up to the Civil War, their understanding of European politics, at least, was shaped in part by Karl Marx, even though they didn't really understand the significance of that at the time.
You write, when, you know, when we think about the impact of Marx in America, a country that the official politics of which has been so consistently anti-communist, anti-Marxist, you write that there are three different lineages of Marx's influence on the United States. One is based on his understandings of labor exploitation of the working class as being absolutely fundamental to the workings and profits of capital, of capitalism. A second is how American thinkers managed to marry his ideas to other traditions, which we'll get into later. And a third is how Marx was kind of a loathsome foil for conservatives and also for liberals who used their anti-Marxism as a way of defining what they themselves stood for. And I wanted to start with the first of these, Marx as a theorist of labor exploitation and working class struggle under capitalism. When did those ideas of Marx first get traction in the United States, and what form did that influence take?
Marx, the theorist of working class power, the theorist of labor exploitation, the thinker who revolutionized the labor theory of value, and that is that all value in capitalism derives from labor, and it's wrung from labor in the form of exploitation. That aspect of Marx is really the first aspect of Marx to take off in the United States, precisely because there was a vibrant German socialist culture in cities like New York, Cincinnati, Milwaukee, Chicago, that began reading the first volume of Capital in German, oftentimes serialized in pamphlet form, especially the chapter from Capital known as The Working Day, where he really elaborated on that theory and argued that the struggle to lessen the working day was part of the larger class struggle. And so in the late 19th century and early 20th century, as these socialist or Marxist ideas begin to spread across the country through various socialist parties which are emerging in this time period, especially the Socialist Party of America with Eugene Debs at its helm, and also especially in the Industrial Workers of the World or the Wobblies, this is the idea that takes root. So it's not Marx's ideas from the Communist Manifesto that first begin to spread in American working class culture, militant working class culture, socialist culture. Rather, it's the ideas from Capital, and it's this basic premise of Marx's about labor being the source of value in a capitalist economy, and that capital, in order to derive profit from labor, it must exploit it. That idea really does shape the militant working class movements of the late 19th, early 20th century, the first Gilded Age, and especially takes hold of the Socialist Party of America and Eugene Debs.
You also write about how Marx was read by and reviled by people on the right and also liberals over time. And one of the things that's clear from reading your book, but probably would be clear otherwise, is that anti-communist repression has been a deeply rooted part of American politics as well for, you know, well over a century. And in effect, it sort of highlights the persistence of Marxism in America, of course, as an objectionable thing. I wonder if you could talk about that thread of the right seeing Marx as this bogeyman figure and the way that took real political form in terms of repression in the early 20th century.
Marx himself, for the most part during his lifetime, was not famous, was not well known. But in the 1870s, so in the last decade of his life, he died in 1883, he began to be a name that people were becoming familiar with, in part because he was the intellectual leader of the International Working Men's Association, or the IWA, the First International. And the First International, along with Marx and his ideas, began to be blamed for things that conservatives, reactionaries, people in power disliked happening around the world, beginning with the Paris Commune of 1871. Marx himself had nothing to do with the Paris Commune, neither really did the First International, and yet they, Marx and the First International were blamed by an American and British press for this thing in what I would call one of the first mini Red Scares. And anytime there was a Red Scare from then on out, Marx's name was dragged out and stepped upon, sort of dragged through the mud. So, for example, in 1877, there's this great railroad strike across the country that results in something approaching a general strike in St. Louis, what some people referred to as the St. Louis Commune. Marx is blamed for this. Even though dead, he's later blamed for the Haymarket Square affair in Chicago, or the Haymarket Riot. And this persists in all of these mini Red Scares, and so Marx's name becomes a scare tactic. This takes this is taken to new levels during and after the First World War and during and after the Bolshevik Revolution. This is what historians refer to as the first Red Scare. To begin with, intense restrictions on free speech were placed upon people mostly focused on the left, those who were critical of American entry into the war. This resulted, for example, in Eugene Debs being arrested and imprisoned for giving a speech that, although not entirely about the war, mentioned his opposition to the war. Immediately after the war, there was repression picked up pace. The Wobblies, whom local and state police had long wanted to dismantle, they used the occasion to do just that. The Wobblies were effectively shut down in the late 19-teens. Some of them were even lynched by lynch mobs. And thousands of socialists, anarchists, Marxists, essentially, were deported, many of them back to Russia. Many more were put in prison. And so part of the reason why the 1920s is now known as such a conservative time in American history, a time of big business, a time of the second Ku Klux Klan and extreme nativism, a lot of this has to do with the fact that the left was ultimately destroyed, and Marx's name was mixed up as part of this intensely, especially as there's something of a Bolshevik scare. The Russian Revolution, of course, in 1917 meant that lots of American socialists and people on the left turned to Russia as a model for what they were hoping to achieve in the United States. But this just intensified the Red Scare atmosphere. And so throughout the American reception of Marx, there are these what I call boom periods, and that is time periods when lots of Americans are reading Marx favorably. But then also there would be, I guess, on the reverse, bust periods, and the time after World War I was certainly one of those, and not too many Americans were reading Marx favorably in the 1920s, in large part because of this Red Scare and because Marx's name was so central to it.
That's the voice of historian Andrew Hartman, author of Marx in America. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So in that cycle of booms and busts, of a turning toward Marx in the United States, following those terrible years of repression of the teens in the early 20s, then, of course, in the 1930s, following the stock market crash of 1929, was the cataclysmic Great Depression. How did Marxism manage to burst back onto the scene again in the 1930s, in that period? And what form did that kind of American Marxism take?
During the 1930s, upwards of a third of Americans were unemployed. And in that setting, the sort of climate of repression started to fade away, and labor began to get organized quite intensely, especially through the newly formed Congress of Industrial Organizations, or the CIO. And there were many, many, many militant strikes. The high water mark of these strikes were in 1934. So labor militancy is a real force in the nation, probably unlike at any other time in U.S. history. Involved in this whole movement are various left-wing parties, but especially the Communist Party of the United States, which had gone underground during the 1920s in response to repression and in modeling itself after the Russian Bolsheviks, probably wrongheadedly. But by the 1930s, they began to come out of the shadows, and the Communist Party during the 1930s, close to perhaps a million people in the United States entered into the Communist Party at any given time during the 1930s. So it's a real force, and a whole culture around the Communist Party builds up. And part of this culture is reading Marx. Marx becomes widely read in this time period. In fact, most intellectuals, if they were worth anything, believed that they had to have something to say about Karl Marx in the 1930s. And so you see a whole host of academics, philosophers, social scientists, historians, holding themselves up in libraries and digging deep into Marx and writing books about Marx in an effort to attempt to understand not just what had caused the Great Depression, but how we might go beyond capitalism. Marx had written extensively, especially in the second and third volumes of Capital, about what caused crises, how capitalism caused crisis. And of course, so the crisis of the 1930s, which started in 1929, was much worse, probably the worst crisis in the history of capitalism, was much worse than the previous one of 1893, which was worse than the one of 1873, which was worse than 1857, and so on. And so Marx was thought of by people as a prophet, that he understood the workings of capitalism, and that not only would he help them figure out and try to understand what was causing depression, but also how they could get out of it. And so it seemed like, you know, revolution was in the air, and Marx was the tribune of that revolution in that time period. And interestingly enough, this is also a time period when you begin to get lots of these thinkers mixing Marx and Marxism with various American traditions. Perhaps most prominently in this era, you get a philosopher like Sidney Hook, who writes in 1932, Towards an Understanding of Karl Marx, which I would rank up there as one of the best books written about Karl Marx by an American thinker. And he mixes Marxism with pragmatism. He had studied pragmatic philosophy under John Dewey at Columbia, and he's kind of mixing these two together in a way that he thought would work really well for Americans. And in doing so, he, because he had studied in Germany and in Moscow, and because he read German, he was reading and translating some of the early Marx writings, which had yet to be translated into English, and had come up with a Marx that seemed very small d democratic, very flexible, very pragmatic. And this was a Marx that was very compelling to lots of people.
And we'll return to the fate of some of these thinkers who we associate with the liberal tradition and how they ended up thinking about Marx. But you write about how Marxism, since Marx's writing, has influenced American politics in various ways. And one of them is by people melding Marxism with other ideas. How would you say, looking back, did Marx influence the liberalism of the New Deal?
Marx, Marxism, but also especially the large and militant labor movement, the communist movement of the 1930s, was part of what convinced Franklin Roosevelt, FDR, and those who helped build the New Deal, that it was necessary to inject some degree of socialism to empower the working class to some degree in order to save capitalism and in order to save their American democracy as they understood it. In fact, Roosevelt, and especially many of those in his brain trust, were very conscious of them doing just this in a world that was being torn apart by the emergence of fascism, and also in a world where the largest country in the world by land mass was communist, and all spoke very highly of Karl Marx. American liberals, and really in the 1930s, FDR is the first to embrace this term liberal. American liberals recognized that if they wanted to have capitalism, and they did, they couldn't just leave it to the capitalists, because the capitalists seemed to be running capitalism aground, and that was the problem that was leading to fascism or communism. And so it's not that they necessarily were outspokenly taking Marx's ideas and applying them to American politics, but there was a certain subterranean use of Marx because they were trying to co-opt the militant labor movement, which had definitely taken some of Marx's ideas to heart in the ways in which they were organizing. And they brought the labor movement into the Democratic Party fold, into the New Deal fold. They also somewhat ironically brought the Communist Party into the fold. One historian of the Communist Party argues that it was a junior partner in FDR's New Deal, and I think that's accurate.
And yet, with the rise of fascism, the Communist Party in the United States in many ways played down its Marxism to better promote its Americanness, you know, this idea that Marxism would be foreign, which is a big theme of the right and of liberals. I wonder if you could tell us about that period, the period of the Popular Front against fascism and the alliances that it entailed and where Marx ended up in that moment.
Right. So it's in the early 1930s, especially around the time of the first New Deal and leading up to the great strikes or the great year of labor upheaval in 1934. This is when so many people in the United States are reading Marx explicitly calling themselves Marxists. And it's not that people necessarily who consider themselves Marxists, especially those in the Communist Party, necessarily dropped their Marxism entirely. But as part of joining a popular front, and that became the official policy coming from out of the Soviet Union, and that is that to fight fascism, the communist parties around the world, the Comintern, the Communist International, had to make peace with liberalism, had to make peace with the democratic institutions in countries like the United States. And in so doing, that was going to be the most effective way to fight fascism. In lots of people in the United States who were a part of the communist movement, whether they had joined the party or not, were, I think, relieved by this policy because they were patriotic. They did believe in the American project. It's just that they also were communists or socialists. I think this gave them the freedom to proclaim, as Earl Browder, the leader of the Communist Party, did during the Popular Front period, that communism is 20th century Americanism. And so they could become patriotic as they were organizing in the labor unions, as they were doing various other forms of political organization, as some of them were rising up the ranks of various institutions. And so the irony there is that as American liberal, this is probably like the high watermark of American liberalism's embrace of what I might call Marx light. Marx himself was de-emphasized. And so like you get an intellectual movement by the late 30s, early 40s, very much grounded in the Popular Front, which forms American Studies. And there is a very conscious effort to downplay Marx and other European philosophies and embrace the radical ideas that emerged in an American context, especially American transcendentalism, Emerson, Thoreau, Walden, whatnot.
Thank you.
This is the Old Mull Variety Hour on KBOO Community Radio. That's Night and Day, played by Art Tatum in 1948, and author Andrew Hartman, who teaches history at Illinois State University, speaking with Against the Grain host Sasha Lilly about anti-communist oppression in the early 20th century on Against the Grain, and you're hearing it here on KBOO Community Radio. Here's more from their conversation recorded for KPFA in Berkeley, California, Sasha Lilly and Against the Grain for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Andrew Hartman, you mentioned earlier that the fortunes of Marx in the United States have followed on a cycle of booms and busts, and clearly if that was sort of a boom, as you say, the sort of high watermark of a certain kind of embrace of Marxism, that following World War II, with McCarthyism, it was a profound and violent bust. Can you tell us about the McCarthy era and how both conservatives and also Cold War liberals position themselves vis-a-vis Marxism?
Yeah, so as will be undoubtedly familiar to most of your listeners, the 1940s and 1950s is probably the most profoundly anti-communist era in American history. McCarthyism, or what historians refer to as the Second Red Scare, was every bit as politically repressive as the First Red Scare, but even more repressive at the level of culture. It became a deeply fearful time for people on the left, fearful that you would lose your job, fearful that you would end up in prison, fearful that your family would be persecuted. And in the context of the early Cold War, when the Soviet Union very quickly replaced Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan as the enemy, it became dangerous for people to be openly Marxist. And so, like, for example, one of my favorite Marxists from the 1930s, Kenneth Burke, a cultural critic of sorts who wrote extensively about Marx during the 1930s, came out with new editions of several of his most prominent books from the 1930s, came out with new editions in the 1950s that he had lightly edited to remove all mention of Marx. This is like one of many, many such examples. Sidney Hook, the aforementioned brilliant Marxist philosopher, he first became a Cold War liberal and then later became a neoconservative in the 1980s. President Ronald Reagan gave him the Medal of Freedom to give you a sense of where he had gone. In the 1960s, when there was another sort of upswing of interest in Marx, lots of young radicals came to Sidney Hook and they wanted, they asked him if they could put out a new edition of his book, Toward an Understanding of Karl Marx, because it was very hard to get a hold of, and he simply refused. He didn't want that aspect of his intellectual life to be brought out into the open again. Immediately during World War II and after, you see the emergence of a very powerful strain of liberal thought that I didn't realize when I first started researching this how deeply opposed to Marx this whole strain was. I knew that it was anti-Marxist, but it seems every liberal intellectual who became well-known had to write a book, or at least had to write extensively about Marx in order to sort of exorcise the Marxist demons of the 1930s. And they invented this American political tradition in the 1940s and 50s, or what some might call the liberal tradition, very much, very consciously in opposition to Marx. So you had intellectuals ranging from Edmund Wilson to Hannah Arendt to Arthur Schlesinger Jr. to Reinhold Niebuhr, who during the 1930s had been something of a Marxist, to many more, including Walter Rostow, who worked in the Johnson administration on the Vietnam War. They all came out with books and articles that interrogated Marx to argue that Marx was wrong and America, the very existence of America, especially the existence of the New Deal, had proved him wrong. But then, of course, at the same time, you had lots of conservatives were reading Marx. Now, they were part of this sort of reactionary tradition going back to the late 19th century that was kind of about vigilantism and repression, and they didn't necessarily take Marx's ideas seriously. There were some conservative intellectuals who took his ideas seriously during the 1950s and 60s to criticize him, but rather they weren't out to disprove him in the way liberals were, because for them, the idea that Marx was wrong was a foregone conclusion. Rather, their objective was to demonstrate that liberalism in the form of the New Deal was Marxism or was a close cousin of Marxism. So their enemy all along was liberalism. And I think you see this persist up into the present when you hear President Trump or other right-wing personalities on the radio like Mark Levin talk about Marxism, when they really, it's just become a pejorative for mildly progressive reforms that they dislike, like the Green New Deal or diversity initiatives.
Andrew Hartman is my guest. He's a professor of history at Illinois State University and the author of Marx in America. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, Andrew, before we move further, I wanted to ask you for your take on the liberals who, and sometimes conservatives, who made their way through Marxism and then ended up as some of its strongest critics. You mentioned earlier Edmund Wilson, but there are many others. I mean, obviously, there was a whole lot that went on in mid-century, and the revelations of the crimes of the Soviet Union and the role of the Communist Party of the United States for justifying or papering over those things, the Hungarian Revolution and the mid-1950s, all of these play a role. But in seeing these people who then moved from the Marxist left to the, let's say, reactionary center or the very defined right, do you see these things as part of a personal tale, which I think is often how it's framed, or do you understand it, since you are looking at this as an intellectual historian, in a different light?
Just as a quick qualifier, there were lots of Marxists in the 1930s who remained Marxist to some degree, even as they might have rejected the Communist Party. And in fact, many of the people who kept Marxism alive through the repression and on into the 1960s were on the left in the 1930s. And because some of the most famous of these apostates, you might call them, because they were such famous intellectuals, and part of their fame was because they made this ideological U-turn, we tend to focus on them. But I think for good reason, because there's enough of them to make a statement about that. And I think a lot of it has to do with like larger social and political pressures. Most of them who wrote about their turn away from Marxism or communism did so because they all wrote sort of memoirs or self-tales. They would focus on their individual struggles and the ways in which oftentimes they had been wronged by communists. But some of the more astute ones would talk about just their shock at the revelations of Stalin's crimes, for example. But you mentioned that a lot had happened in the middle of the 20th century. I just think that's the best. It might be the easiest, simplest explanation, but it's also the best explanation. I think it would be rare for people to live through the world's biggest depression, capitalism's greatest crises, a world war that ended with revelations about the Holocaust, you know, millions of Jews and others being systematically destroyed in Europe, and the atomic bomb, and then immediately following that, being sort of at ideological odds with the Soviet Union, which had committed atrocities themselves. Too many people in the United States, I guess, associated these horrible events and deeply traumatic transformations. They associated them with these strong ideologies that included Marxism, and they just were repulsed by it in that setting. And they had a lot of political and social incentive to move away from it as well, to become a renowned academic, intellectual, pundit, writer in the 1950s. Required that you never have been a Marxist, or that you renounced it in pretty pretty pronounced fashion, which is not to say that they were necessarily sellouts, that they, I think most of them became true believers in some version of Americanism, whether the liberal or conservative version of it, but there were just immense political and social pressures. And it, you know, the middle of the 20th century was a pressure cooker, and hardly anyone came out of it unscathed.
Andrew Hartman is my guest. We're discussing Marx in America. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Let's talk then about those radicals who stayed radical through those very dark years that you're describing. And many of them made some of the more significant contributions to American Marxism. Can you tell us about writers who viewed the revelations of the mid-20th century, including about the Soviet Union, who analyzed and understood those events from the left?
One of the more intriguing figures that I focus on in my book is a woman by the name of Raya Dunaskaeva. She was a Russian immigrant who, in the 1930s, as a young person, was drawn to communism and joined the Communist Party in the United States. She was an avid, avid reader of Marx. Very early on, she was kicked out of the party rather violently because she had asked her local chapter to kind of read Trotsky's report on Stalin's purges, which was, you know, of course, verboten. But rather than turn to the right, she always remained on the left. She always remained a Marxist. And at first she turned to Trotskyism, which was a very common place for disaffected communists who wanted to remain on the left to go. And in fact, she served as Trotsky's personal secretary in Mexico City right up until the time the KGB murdered Trotsky in 1940. Then she came back to the United States and she began organizing with others, especially in Detroit, where she hooked up with a woman by the name of Grace Lee and with C.L.R. James, who's also a major figure in my book. These were people who had been sort of floating around the Trotskyist movement or the anti-Stalinist left, who even became disenamored with Trotskyism, but they're still on the left, and they formed kind of a branch of Marxism. They called themselves the Johnson Forest Tendency, but really what they were all intellectuals, and they formulated a brand of Marxism they called Marxist humanism. They had great language skills, so they translated many of Marx's early writings, which were much more sort of the musings of a young existentialist humanist than they were the sort of cold, calculating words of an anti-capitalist philosopher. And they believed in democracy. They wrote about the United States. They cared about feminism. They cared about civil rights. But they still remained Marxist throughout this time period. Raya Dunaskaeva's 1963 book, Marxism and Freedom, became one of the most read Marxist books during the 1960s. It really inspired a lot of young new leftists during that time period. I also track the Marxists who formed the independent socialist magazine Monthly Review, which is still being published to this day, always Marxist, never affiliated with any one party, so always independent. Some of their early thinkers, such as Paul Sweezy and Harry Magdoff, wrote some of the most interesting economic and political analyses rooted in Marx during the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and remained true to their Marxism. They expanded upon Marx to help explain things like American capitalism after World War II, which had seemingly stabilized due to the power of not just the state, but corporations. They wrote extensively, in the case of Harry Magdoff, about a new form of imperialism that was emerging that would become extremely concrete with the Vietnam War. They never strayed from their Marxism, and they stayed on the left, even though it was highly unpopular to do so during this time period.
So following that kind of wilderness where such people did keep the Marxist flame alive and contributed to the American Marxist tradition, following that period, of course, there was then the explosion of the New Left in the 1960s. And of course, you know, there are many Marxes. Marx was someone who wrote extensively about so many different things, whether about the inner workings of capitalism or theories of capitalist breakdown or life after capitalism, empire. He wrote on the environment. There are many parts of Marx which one could draw on. What would you say did the New Left embrace of Marx's writings and ideas?
Early on, you get, for example, young intellectuals and historians in places like the University of Wisconsin at Madison who formed a really influential journal of the early New Left called Studies on the Left. They were well-versed in Marx. They had been taught by Marxist professors, often Frankfurt School professors, so German emigres, or I should say sometimes German, but European emigres. And they oftentimes were interested in Marx's more economic thought, but they were interested in understanding how Marx's theories applied to what had become of 20th century American capitalism. And a lot of really interesting thought comes out of that, which you could say stays true to the labor side of Marx to some degree. But as the New Left expands and flowers and takes up all sorts of issues, anti-war especially, but also its focus on civil rights, eventually Black power, Chicano power, American Indian power, feminism, gay rights, the list goes on. This is when many, many different Marxes get picked up. One of the Marxes that really comes to the forefront during this time period is the young Marx, the sort of Marxist humanism that Raya Dunaskaeva had written about. And a lot of this is because, well, now these early Marx writings are available in English, thanks to people like Dunaskaeva, but also these were existentialist musings to an extent. Now, when Marx was talking in, for example, his economic and philosophic manuscripts that he wrote in 1844, which is kind of like the core text of the early Marx, he was worried about something that would later become known as capitalism, the way in which it was dividing people from their labor, from their fellow humans, from themselves, and in a process that he called alienation. So he was very concerned with capitalism. The New Left sometimes was concerned with capitalism, but even more so kind of concerned with what seemed to them a repressive political culture that, even though economically speaking, perhaps they had become a part of what people called the middle class, they were often college students. This is perhaps the period in American history where wealth had been more widely shared than any other period, especially for white people. This was so it was less a focus on the later economic sort of class struggle Marx, and much more a focus on, why do we feel so disconnected from life? Why do we feel alienated? And so I think there might be sort of like a implicit connection between the early Marx and the Tom Hayden who authored the Port Huron Statement, the founding document of Students for a Democratic Society in 1962, just kind of looking out at the world and not feeling things were right, feeling like they didn't have a say over their life, that life wasn't authentic, wasn't real to them.
Well, Andrew Hartman, you write in Marx in America about another period of sort of retrenchment when the politics of the United States swung to the right during Reagan and Marxism went into the universities, something that the right will, I guess, never forgive the universities for. I wonder, though, in the interest of time, skipping ahead, if we could talk about our time, because you write that the time that we're living through right now is really the fourth boom in American interest in Marx, and that Americans have returned to Marx in a degree not seen since the 1960s, maybe possibly since the 1930s. Why do you think that is? Can we simply boil it down to the global financial crisis of 2008? Or is it more complicated? Were Americans, in fact, turning to Marx in some number before then?
People, not just in the U.S., but elsewhere, were not really turning to Marx extensively prior to 2008. To me, that was a little bit surprising because me personally, having become a person on the left in the 1990s, I had started reading Marx and I had started making sort of Marxist connections that allowed me to understand, I thought, like the politics driving the anti-globalization movement and the politics driving the resistance to the U.S. war in Iraq in 2003. But as a historian, when I began really digging into it, there just wasn't a lot of reading and writing about Marx in those settings. It really isn't until the financial crisis of 2008 when all of a sudden there's a massive explosion. And I guess I would argue that it's because that financial collapse seemed so much the result of just the workings of capitalism, explicitly so, in ways that Marx could help us understand. And lots of thinkers did indeed turn to Marx to help us understand that crisis. Maybe most prominently among them, the longtime Marxist geographer and writer David Harvey, who right about this time period begins to put his longstanding class that he teaches on Capital, Marx's Capital, he began to put it online as a podcast and eventually as a YouTube video that people could download and watch or listen to. And in that setting becomes probably, he probably has taught more people how to read Capital than any other person in U.S. history, interestingly enough. And then just there, it just begins to build, it begins to flower. You get the early building of what we now think of as millennial socialism, and lots of these activists, organizers, and intellectuals, sometimes in graduate school, sometimes people who went to graduate school couldn't get jobs because of the crisis of the academic labor market, and they're reading and writing about Marx, they're forming Marx reading groups. This is the building up of podcasts in the context of the building up of Democratic Socialists of America, which interestingly was founded by Michael Harrington in 1982, who's a key figure in my book as like somebody trying to keep a political, what I would call democratic socialist Marx alive through the Reagan years. And then, of course, the Bernie Sanders campaign. There just seemed to be a cascading of interest in the left and Marx, I think because capitalism had returned to a form that Marx had written about, that is like rate inequality, much more exploitation, the falling away of labor unions, all the things that we've seen during and after the neoliberal era. This, it just seems like Marx once again spoke to the moment in ways that perhaps he hadn't since the 1930s.
Well, it's also interesting in the period that you're talking about and even before the global financial crisis, was that in the late 1990s, with increasing turbulence in the global economy, it seemed like writers for publications like The Economist, kind of the mouthpiece of capitalist economics in a journalistic form, journalistic neoliberalism, I guess I say, started to say, well, you know, maybe there are things we can actually learn from Marx, not about any idea that society might, you know, be something else, something egalitarian that we might call socialism or communism, but that Marx might give us insight into the workings of this highly turbulent global system of capitalism. So that would seem to be one way that Marx influenced a kind of more centrist, liberal understanding of the world. At the same time, we have seen, certainly this is something that one hears about from Trump, but long predates him, this notion that cultural Marxism is this noxious force that is destroying the fabric of American society, a kind of bogeyman that looms over the society at large, especially, of course, the universities. How do you see the emergence of cultural Marxism as a bogeyman for the right? Where did that come from?
Yeah, the concept of cultural Marxism is something that Marxist theorists had been aware about going back to the 1920s and 30s when you had writers like Antonio Gramsci and George Lukács who had transformed Marxism to account for the fact that during the First World War, the working class did not come together across national lines in solidarity and rather had joined in their own nation's, butchery in the war. That was a real puzzle for lots of Marxists. And so part of the explanation was that culture had something to do with it. And so Gramsci famously writing in his prison notebooks argued that the working class came to identify with the ruling class. And so organizing workers was not going to be as simple as just forming unions or socialist parties. We had to organize at the ideological level. This really takes off with the Frankfurt School, a bunch of German Marxists who, of course, went into exile during the rise of Nazism. Many of them landed in the United States, perhaps most famously Herbert Marcuse, who becomes something of a guru of the New Left. And he and others on the Frankfurt School are combining Marxism with cultural theories like Freudianism, like Max Weber's ideas, in some really interesting ways. So cultural Marxism is a real thing, a real historical thing, but the right picks up on it. Several right-wing, organizers, calling them intellectuals might be a stretch, but right-wing pundits, activists in the 1980s, begin to pick up on this, and it becomes a whole conspiracy theory that becomes extremely influential among certain sectors of the right. It has, of course, anti-Semitic overtones, because there's this notion that these European Jews are coming into the U.S. and telling Americans they have to be rootless and they have to quit worrying about traditions like family, even as the anti-Semitic trope goes, they remain deeply rooted to their Jewish family traditions. But the cultural Marxism trope expands beyond the sort of anti-Semitic wing of the reactionary right, and even most prominently, there are several Jewish conservatives like Ben Shapiro who take up this cause. Ben Shapiro even famously said in a speech that he gave at Hillsdale College about 10 years ago that, yeah, lots of people in the Democratic Party might not call themselves Marxists, even as they've been deeply shaped by Marxism. And here he's attributing them being shaped by Marxism to cultural Marxism or the Frankfurt School. This is a whole trope that has about a 30 or 40 year history on the right that's just picked up steam. And yes, it does seem like people surrounding Trump are bought into this, and it's helped inform their efforts to, root out whatever they see as Marxism from the university, even though, interestingly, most of their funding cuts have been affecting the hard sciences.
Well, I hate to leave things on such a bleak note, but of course, that's where we are now. Andrew Hartman, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real joy.
Andrew Hartman is professor of history at Illinois State University. He's the author of Marx in America. His other books include Education and the Cold War and A War for the Soul of America. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly.
And I'm John Nelson for the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO Community Radio for the 1st of December, 2025. Thanks to Sasha Lilly and her guest Andrew Hartman, author of Karl Marx in America, Against the Grain is a weekly radio show hosted and produced at KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California. It's a program of ideas, in-depth analysis, and commentary on political, economic, social, and cultural issues important to radical thinking and activism. There on the web at againstthegrain.org, you can find this episode of the Old Mall Variety Hour alongside other archived episodes in time at kboo.fm. Just search for the Old Mall Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the KBOO website at kboo.fm.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations of programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public